is Gorgeous Lives, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
She was born into an artistic family, raised in an unconventional way. She became an artist. She was the original Blitz Kid from the 80s. She was the youngest manager ever of a ever so fashionable Zanzibar and Covent Garden. She became a successful novelist with 4 adult books and 4 teenage books. Hope I've got that right. She adores Soho and wrote a book about the Colney Rooms. She is Sophie Parkin. She is now the owner of her own thriving club in Shoreditch. Welcome, Sophie, to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you, Josephine.
Now, you've got to tell us the name of it, because I often worry about how I'm going to say the name of your club.
Well, you can call it Vouterini's or Vouterini's. It doesn't really matter. Slim Gaylard used to use both Vout and Voot.
Now, is it something to do with beatniks, the name?
The name is a book of jive, a dictionary of jive slang written by Slim Gaylard, and it's the language that is used in On the Road, and the gig that they're trying to get to is one of Slim Gaylard's in San Francisco. So it is all kind of interconnected, but he actually wrote the dictionary in about 1938, I think.
And were the words like hip and cool and, you know, kind of bebop sort of words? Those sort of
yeah, all of that, but slightly more eccentric than that.
And so what does
Vouterini mean? Don't yes. put a French accent on there, because that's ridiculous.
I was going to say Vouterini. Yeah. In my way.
Sounds like something, some awful sitcom, doesn't it? No, it's supposed to be Vouterini's. Vouterini's means having a good time.
Here we are at your club. So why do we need this club?
Everybody needs a club where they can feel that they're home from home. And sometimes you don't even feel at home in home. So it's especially valuable. You need a place where you can relax into, that it's not important what you're doing or how well you're doing it at that moment, that you're accepted for who you are, not what you are.
You do have an extraordinary artistic background, which I've already mentioned. Your dad was the more conventional one. He was an art dealer around Chelsea, Michael Parkin Gallery. And then your mum was the more colourful, famous. I mean, she's the queen of bohemia in the UK. She's called Molly Parkin. She wrote, she was a fashion editor for Nova, and then she wrote some incredible pre kind of sexy novels. You know what I mean? She made a hell of a lot of money. She was very successful. And you were brought up in this crazy, crazy upbringing. Can you tell us something about that?
I don't know that she made a hell of a lot of money. I think that might be wishful thinking.
Well, she took people out for dinner, she says in her biography, every night.
We'll question that.
Okay.
She lived a expansive lifestyle, and she had a lot of wealthy friends. I think that helps when you're taking people out for dinner. Remember, that was before credit cards existed.
So you needed friends with credit.
You needed friends with cash.
Tell us about your upbringing then.
I got brought up in Chelsea. My dad was one of the directors of Caroline Radio, and then he went on to start Caroline Films. My mum, they separated when I was like 1 and a half. We lived in Old Church Street, 4 doors down from the Chelsea Arts Club, which was a bohemian hub at that time. Every Friday and Saturday night, the police were called because there was always a fight going on. Then my father went on to retrain and went into dealing pictures. So he became an art dealer, had a gallery in Belgravia for 30 years. My mother started off as an artist. She came from the Valleys in Wales and worked her way into English society, as it was known. She had to have elocution lessons, otherwise apparently you couldn't understand what the Welsh say, especially if they came from Willesden. And she then got divorced from my dad. She was a very successful painter, The Tate had already bought a couple of pictures. And when she got divorced from my dad, I think it wasn't just the financial thing. I think she found it very difficult to paint.
With two little children, yeah.
She had two little children, but back in those days, in the early 60s, men were very much supposed to be the breadwinners. That was the deal. But my father was always taking my mum's paintings and going and selling them, keeping the money himself, you know. Rogues are not a thing just of the present. So my mother got offered a job on a new magazine that was starting called Nova. And because she wasn't involved in fashion, that's why she made such a good fashion editor, because all she thought about was colour and shape. And so she became the first magazine editor to use a black model, which was thought absolutely shocking. But Nova was an unusual magazine because it was political. It wasn't just for women. And it had things like cartoons in it. And it's hard to explain, but in those days, there was, you know, Vogue and Harper's, and all it was just women's twatter, whatever, you know, just things about clothes and what women should be interested in, apparently. But the 60s came along, and I think it was about women being much more open to the rest of the world, not shut behind the front door in the kitchen with the kids all the time. And I think my mum exemplified that, along with Irma Kurtz, who was one of the feature writers, became my mum's best friend. When my mum left Nova because she got sacked, she was always getting sacked for having arguments. She was probably drunk at the time as well. But then they used to do most of their editing in the pub. And I don't think that's a place which sold much Fever Tree tonic water at that time. So you would start, you know, laying out a page. This is when she went on to work in Fleet Street at the Sunday Times. They would do all their...
fashion editor again?
Fashion editor. Well, she went from Nova. She opened her own boutique, sold it to Terence Donovan, the photographer, then opened up a restaurant. Irma Kurtz was one of the waitresses. It was disastrous. It lasted 2 months, and then she had to put clothes on the door because it all just got a bit too much. She couldn't find a chef to make the food, so she'd just pretend it was really late.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives.
just get make everybody buy loads and loads of champagne, and then
perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you need to eat anyway?
Exactly.
So that didn't go down too well. Then she got offered a job on Harper's, and she was the first person to kind of do that thing of a barometer, what's going up, what's coming down kind of thing. Then she left. I think she got the sack from there as well. I think that's where she did the photograph of a load of Debs sitting in a line in ball gowns in public toilets.
Fabulous.
And
God, that was an outrage, I suppose. Yeah,
totally outrageous. Yeah. It was the 70s. It wasn't even punk by then.
Yeah.
So
at the same time, you were brought up, did you see your mum?
Yeah, all the time.
Who looked after you when she was at work?
We had au pair girls.
Did they stay? Because mine didn't.
We had one Italian who stayed for a long time. We had a German one who we managed to get sacked for sleeping with men and various other things that she was getting up to. But then she stole all my mum's clothes when she left, so it wasn't a happy ending. Then there was... then we just had... The cleaning woman used to kind of be there when we came back from school. And in those days, it was very different, I think, because...
You could walk to school, you were free, all those things.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody thought it was weird to see, you know, a six-year-old or a five-year-old walking along the road by themselves. Mm. It was assumed that they knew where they were going.
Yeah.
and that they had a sense of direction.
And you did.
And you did. Yeah, you knew that you were going to school and coming back.
I just want to ask, so you were brought up with this background of two very artistic, kind of unpredictable parents. So was it kind of predictable for you to become an artist, if you know what I mean? Was that like always on the cards?
No, I don't think so. I think it was on the cards that I became a writer. Which I did, because I was always reading the whole time. But
so was that like an escape?
Yes, very much so. I think if I didn't have a book with me, I started to feel very insecure. Yeah. And in a weird way that children find the places that are most comfortable, I always managed to find a bookshop or a library wherever I was going. Or I'd find the books in somebody's house or something like that.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives.
So did you read like books that were beyond you? I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, did you read quite grown-up books when you were young?
Yeah, I think by the time I was 10, I'd read all the books in the children's library, so I had to go upstairs. Yeah, I think my reading age was far, far beyond the normal. I think I'd read all of Evelyn Waugh's books by the time I was 13.
Because I want to talk about the past, because your image is really strong. Today, I mean, Sophie's always got a different look. Today she's got red hair, fringe up, bright red lips, red nail varnish. She's got a kind of 1940s kind of shirt dress. She's got little black and white shoes, black ankle socks. You know, she's always very strong, and you've always nodded to the past. I mean, what is your relationship with the past?
I think I got born out of my time. Or maybe it was because I started reading old books when I was so young, or a certain level of old books. I definitely, you know, when I started to look at paintings and photographs of everything from Bill Brandt's photos to... I suppose Cecil Beaton's images of the Mitford sisters, all of that kind of stuff, Harry Diamond's old pictures of Soho, it kind of rang bells with me, and I think I understood the way they behaved much. It was more understandable to me than often the ways that my own generation behaved, which I couldn't quite grasp. And
so did you feel different to other people at school?
Yeah, always. Always. Didn't mean that I didn't have friends. I always did have friends, but I always felt very separate from people. But I don't know whether that's because, you know, I've got some undiagnosed condition, might be. Or it might be, you know, that I had kind of a vaguely traumatic childhood, in that I was shown things probably too early for most children. But then children get, you know, brought up in all sorts of circumstances. So I don't want to say that I'm any different from, I mean, for goodness sake, the refugees and what they're having to go through as children is absolutely diabolical. And that happened before in the war as well. So, you know, maybe everybody is unusual and special and feels different.
Yeah. It's just you haven't talked to them about it. Yeah. Now, I want to talk about Soho and want to talk about the Colony Rooms, which people might not have heard about. Can you tell us about the Colony Rooms and also why you've written a book about them and why you have a passion for the Colony Rooms?
The Colony Room Club, to give it its proper name, was an extraordinary place. But, you know, as with so much in life, you don't realise how extraordinary it is until it's taken away from you. So the ordinary and the everyday often becomes the mundane, but you should try and stand back from things and not take things for granted.
When did you first go there? With your mum?
I first went there with my mum and my stepfather when I was roughly 13 years old. And it was an adult drinking establishment. They didn't serve Coca-Cola there. They didn't serve crisps or peanuts.
Oh, how annoying for you.
In case that might dilute the alcohol. I don't think I drank anything when I was there. There was nothing for me to drink. Everybody was drinking, you know, vodka and tonics or gin and tonics in those days. And straight whiskey was the drink. And I just stood and watched and listened and kind of gaped a little bit, open-mouthed, and kind of tried to join in conversation, got shot down, and thought, I'm not quite ready for this place, which I wasn't. And then I became a member when I was 18, and I was going to...
18th birthday present from your mum.
Yes. Yep. And my dad gave me membership of the Chelsea Arts Club.
God, not bad, eh? Not bad.
Well, it's two very... what did they tell you about my parents? Yeah, yeah. They were very interested in drinking.
Yeah, yeah. With a mask of bohemianism.
Yeah. But, yes, it was about drinking. But I think it's about conversation, and it's a bit like giving a child a place to be where you know that, in a way, your friends are going to be looking out for them. And
because a club must mean... Isn't the idea of a club that you do have something in common with the people that go there?
Yeah, you have something in common, but also that, you know, people looked out for each other and looked out for each other's children or wives or husbands or, you know, it's a kind of network of care in a rather kind of uncaring part of town.
So can you tell us about the woman who was the character behind, or in front, I should say, of the Colney Rooms?
I suppose you have to put it in perspective of post-war Britain, 1948. In one square mile of Soho, there was 500 private drinking clubs. This was only one of many, obviously. But what was extraordinary about it was not only its longevity, that it managed to survive until 2008, so that's 60 years. So it went through three owners. Started off with Muriel Belcher, who originally ran clubs like the Music Box for the Bright Young Things, so that's Evelyn Waugh's gang. And then she left it to her barman, Ian Board, who used to be a butler for Elizabeth Taylor. And then he left it to his ward, who was an ex-junkie. Well, wasn't even ex when Ian Board met him. He was a Polish junkie. And Ian kind of saved him, really, and gave him a job and looked after him and made sure he kept off the stuff. And all of those things I discovered in researching the book. And they're not the things that you knew at the time that you were going there. You just, it didn't even cross your mind to think about those things, about that Ian Board had come from Somerset, and that everybody said Muriel Belcher was a, she used to say she was a Jewish Portuguese lesbian. And
what she, was she really?
She wasn't Portuguese, she wasn't Jewish, she was Welsh. I know all those things you discover, but you have to dig and do a lot of research. And but it's the thing of fables, isn't it? That's what people like, is a good story. And if you can make up a good story, then you become something of a legend.
Now, what I'm interested in is your club. Is it to do with the Colney Rooms? Is it an impulse in you? Is it, you know, where's your drive for this club, Sophie, from?
After I finished writing the Colney Room book, and I did 60 interviews, roughly, with people for it, and everybody kept on saying to me, where is our colony now? And so I said to my husband, Jan, who's Dutch, everybody keeps on asking, where is the colony. And he said, well, why don't we do one? And so we started looking around Soho, but then we quickly realised what Soho was becoming and what it has now become. And the rogue landlords who are still basically in charge of it, and that they don't do proper contracts up. So they're always, I mean, it's appalling. It's no different from actually when Paul Raymond was in charge, where he would, you know, get people to pay the rent and then chuck them out if he could find somebody who'd pay £1 more a week. There was no security or tenure or anything. So we were looking around there. We're about to sign it somewhere in Denmark Street. Thank God we didn't get it. Otherwise, we'd be completely in the gutter and would have been robbed of all of our money by this hideous man. And we came and found this place between Aldergate and Tower Hill. Really, just by chance.
We're in a church, actually.
Yeah, our landlord is the Catholic Church.
Now, that is so brilliant, Sophie, because you did do those religious paintings. It was obviously part of your calling, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've always been very highly impressed by religious paraphernalia.
So now you're giving, you know, so are these, are they very nice, the kind of the Roman Catholic set?
The priests are lovely. Yeah, I get on very well with them. We don't see them very often, but we don't have any problem with them at all. It's nice.
And was this a drinking place before? Was it a...
It was a drinking place. If you're a Catholic church, you serve wine, so you have to have a license.
Fantastic. God, I love that loophole.
It's not a loophole. It's kind of transparent if you think about it.
So you are literally in the basement of a church because they serve that sweet wine. Fabulous.
I don't think it's that sweet.
Okay, well, I've never tried it, but people say it's sweet because I'm not in...
You're not a Catholic.
No, but I'm not... What's the word? I can't remember the word. I'm not...
Religious.
Anyway, no, anyway, I've never been confirmed.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives.
Now let's talk about the interior, because again I'm feeling a little bit dizzy by the way it's painted. Who painted this? It's got so much character.
Well, once we had the building and the whole place was a complete shithole, and we had to obviously have it replumbed, new electricity, all of that put in. But so that took a lot more of our money than we realised. But we had some basic things that we wanted. We wanted a bunkette seating, so that all had to be handmade. Yeah. And
we're sitting on it now, green velvet.
Green velvet with red. Have you noticed there's red?
Oh, yes.
Buttons,
yeah.
Pushback buttons. But I wanted it to look unusual, but I didn't want it to look cluttered with too many paintings. And I spoke to my friend Sue Dalgleish, who's a wonderful interior designer for the Eaton Square set. And I was talking to her about it and walking around with her, and she was making suggestions. And I was saying, well, the hallway I think should be done like La Belle et la Bête, Jean Cocteau. And so I got Oriel Harwood to make arms coming out of the hallway walls with lights. And then she kindly also agreed to do the ribbon bowed light fittings in the main bar area.
They're very pretty.
And I decided also that I wanted a ship-shaped bar. And this caused a lot of consternation. Nobody wanted to listen to me. And it's one thing everybody comments on, what a great shape for a bar, because it comes out of the walls. And
it's a bow shape, yeah, like the front, like you say, like the front of a ship. So yeah. There's much more room for sitting and talking, and people can talk across the bar.
Exactly. So they're not looking at a mirrored back to see their reflection. So you forget who you are. So it leaves the ego out of it. You're looking at other people's faces. You're having conversations. You're not turning your back on anyone because you're always looking forward to somebody else. And it just makes conversation and introducing people to each other so much easier. So the people who become members here soon find their little coterie of friends very quickly.
Now, I want to talk about membership. Is membership still open or is it very hard to join? How private is it? You know, who's it for, this club?
It's for people who are interested in the arts, and so it's not necessarily just artists. It's people who collect pictures, who are involved in it, who like writing books, painting, music. So it's pretty damn wide. And you kind of see from people when they walk in if they get it. And because the floors are painted as if they're floorboards, but obviously it's paint, giant floorboards, and it's painted with a tiger skin rug with an open mouth, but it's a painting, and it's painted with a bug rug, as if bugs are running all over a rug, which is actually a dance floor, but that's a painting too. And it's painted in the garden room like it's Monet Giverny. And there's a great big fish pond in the middle of it on the floor, but obviously it's a painting. So it's the idea that life can be anything that you want it to be, but you just have to have the imagination to make it so. I think the people who want to be members gravitate towards here, and if they're not right, if they just want to buy their way into something which will slightly amuse their friends maybe for 5 minutes, then you kind of sense that about them and say, you know, maybe you should join the Soho House or something like that.
Yes.
Because the people who come here aren't interested in how much money you make or whether you've managed to get a knighthood or...
Yeah. Or you're making that next film that you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, they're interested if you're making that next film, because if it's something of interest, then they're interested. So we have a lot of filmmakers, actually.
What
members.
I mean is the kind of bullshitting types.
They're not interested in the bullshit, no.
You know those people.
Yeah, and it's not a place for cocaine takers either.
Oh, thank God for that. So bored of that sort of thing.
Yeah, well...
So what do people like doing here? Drinking?
Sitting, drinking, talking. That's it.
Fabulous.
That's
fabulous.
It.
Fabulous.
And if you've got a good crowd of people and the conversation is good... But we also do have amazing jazz pianists here or groups. We have great performers. We have wonderful poetry, live poetry. We have things about books. We have book launches. We have different people curating different nights of cinema. We have...
So there was never a dull moment here, Sophie.
No, it's completely exhausting.
Sophie Parkin, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and telling us about Voot O'Reenies.
Yes, come and see the John Claridge show. It closes on the 21st of July.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
You're welcome, Josephine. It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like to play for my second number. Very beautiful arrangement. Opus a la super McVauti Osculi Rinibo.
Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2016. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.